Good morning. Welcome to Genesis. We are so glad you're hanging out with us this morning. If you're a guest, we're especially grateful that you chose to spend your Sunday morning with us. We hope that our prayers that what that song says will come true, that through music we sing, through the prayers that we pray, through the word that is preached, that literally that we will see the greatness of a God who is and who is glorious and who loves us, but also a God who has made rules and laws. And that's kind of what we're talking about this morning. We're in a series that is looking at the big story of the Old Testament. Have this huge document with tons of different books, tons of different works. And then there are all these stories. And some of us grew up with the stories and maybe had them in a Sunday school class or had the stories given to us by our parents. Maybe we had little, cool little Bible storybooks. Others of us maybe didn't grow up in church and these stories are brand new. But our goal is to kind of walk through this big story of the Old Testament, looking at the smaller stories and show how the big story is doing something, and each smaller story is connected to the big story. Ultimately, the entire story leads us somewhere. The entire story is leading us to Jesus. And if we miss the connection between anything in the Bible and how it leads us to Jesus in the gospel, we will make a mess out of it. And what we're talking about this morning is probably the greatest example, because our story this morning is about this guy Moses that we just kind of sang a little bit about his story. This guy Moses, hearing the voice of God, going on top of the mountain for these people, and while he is up there, God gives him these commandments, the Ten Commandments, and he comes down from the mountain, and he gives the law, the rules, this is how you're supposed to live. And often we read these Ten Commandments and we read the law of God and we think, okay, there's a giant rule book. That's what the Bible is. The Bible is just a giant rule book that's giving me all the laws, all the rules, and how do I live my life? And we try to figure out what to do with that. And if you're kind of a skeptic, the first thing you do is go, wait a minute. I am not cool with the idea of a God who is nothing more than a giant rule-making God, okay? And so to think about that, I was thinking, even sometimes we as humans, our way of making laws is interesting. And there are some very interesting and bizarre laws that places in America have. And I thought I'd show you the top 10 of these, okay? Because we're going to look at God's top 10 list here in just a minute. We're going to look at the top 10 of these. And so here's a few laws that are on the books in different places. Did you realize that in Alabama, bear wrestling matches are prohibited? I read that and I go, okay. My first thought was, really? What led to this? But then it's Alabama. So, it makes a little more sense. Although I don't think there's I don't think there's a whole lot of bears in Alabama, are there? And so I don't know what led to them saying this. I love this. In Georgia, it's illegal to tie a giraffe to a telephone pole. because there's all these giraffes running around Georgia, and this guy rides into town and tied it to a telephone pole, and it kicked the horse, and who knows? How about this? In Kentucky, it's illegal to remarry the same man four different times. I love you, get out. I love you, get out. But the fourth time, you can't take him back. That's it. Okay? That's it. How about this? In Massachusetts, it's illegal to wear a goatee without a license. I need to make sure I know that, okay? Because I now can't go to Massachusetts without either getting a license or shaving. What legislator is sitting in going, we need to have a discussion about the rampant goatees that are just getting, because that is the problem with our country. All right. And I love this. In Carrizozo, New Mexico, it's forbidden for a female to appear unshaven in public. Wow. Here's grandma walking around with a beard. I'm sorry, ma'am. You can't do that. How about this? In Indiana, it's against the law to dress Barbie in Ken's clothes. I missed it. Did I skip one? Here, listen to this one. I'll catch up. I missed one here in the thing. I'm out of order. In New Mexico, it's illegal for a restaurant to call a corned beef sandwich if it's made with white bread and mayonnaise. I actually find that pretty comical. And then the next one, in Indiana, it's against the law to dress Barbie in Ken's clothes. We'd be in trouble at our house because our girls don't know yet, and you know that they're just all dolls, right? We're going to make Ken look really cute. How about in Texas, if you're going to commit a crime, you legally have to give 24 hours notice to the police. Hello, is this the police? I just want to let you know I'm going to hold up QT tomorrow. I'm going to do it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so I'm more than 24 hours in. Please don't arrest me. Once again, brilliance of people. Let's see. In Chico, California, the law states that anybody who detonates a nuclear device within the city limits is liable to a fine of $500. A, is this a problem? And B, $500. Blow up L.A. I'm sorry, that'll be a $500 fine, please. Make the check payable, too. And then this last one is good. In Nicholas County, West Virginia, no clergy members may tell jokes or humorous stories from the pulpit during church services. Stink, I can't preach there, right? no chance. Sometimes when we read stuff, it's funny how we work through what's okay, what's law, what's rules, and then you start reading the Bible and you realize that there are laws, there are commands in the Bible, there are places where God says, this is how you live, this is what your life should look like, I want you to live this way for me. And we go to those and we end up making a mess of them. And as we make a mess of them, we end up creating images of God that are not really accurate, but we don't know what to do with these laws. For those of you who are you're not following Jesus, you haven't figured this thing out, maybe you're even skeptical, the laws may be a big tripping point for you. They seem to be narrow-minded. They seem to be bigoted sometimes. They seem to close people in and box them in. And you know, insiders, outsiders, if you don't keep the list, you can't really be on the inside. And so maybe it's really a barrier for you to even go, man, I'm not digging religion because religion's got all these rules and I don't even know anybody who really keeps them, and I'm definitely not going to try to. And others of us, we've grown up in church and maybe we are followers of Jesus, but there is still this feeling like, yeah, but the laws are there. How do I got to live this way? Because really at the end of the day, God actually doesn't like me unless I keep all the rules. And so I got to do the best I can. And it turns into legalism, which then just gets crazy. Because when we become legalists, we'll end up doing things that are silly. I saw an example of that this morning. I was in Walmart, and I was behind a lady at 8:30 this morning. And they were scanning her stuff, and she had a bottle of wine, right? And so she was going to buy a bottle of wine at Walmart. Now, most of you may not be aware of this. Some of you may because you've tried. But it is illegal in Missouri to buy alcohol before 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. And you got to understand, here's what went on here. Way back in the day, some of us remember, some of us who are kind of my age, we have gray, remember, you couldn't buy alcohol on Sunday. That was the attempt to keep the Sabbath holy. Right? It's like one Ten Commandments. Remember the Sabbath, keep it holy. So you can't buy alcohol. If you go even before me, there used to be a day when the grocery store wasn't even open on Sunday because remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. Well, but the culture has progressed and the culture's like, we don't buy into all this. And so to keep somebody who had a religious viewpoint happy, they ended up with, you can't buy wine on Sunday morning before 9 o'clock. Now think about this. I mean, what does that solve? Well, that person might go buy a bottle of wine and sit in the back of the church and drink all through the service. But somebody along the line said, this is a good idea. It's at least something in keeping the laws of God, keeping the rules. But at the end of the day, it's just silliness. And what happens, we read the Bible, we go, okay, here's all these rules. And then we wrestle with these rules and we end up going, okay, this is what my life has got to look like because if I don't keep the rules, then I won't be okay with God. And for any of us who really think through that, we will either become very weird in the way we see our lives in the world and the way we see God, or we'll become just somebody who just ditches it all together. And we begin to create images of God in our mind where it, literally in our mind, God looks something like this. God is the school teacher with the ruler ready to beat you with it, you know, or something like this. You're out of here. You didn't keep the rules. You're arguing with me. I'm going to dump you. By the way, I enjoy doing that when I umpire. But anyway, and the, or a God who looks like this. And this becomes the images that almost in our mind that, that our God is like. And so because we see him as this law-giving judge, which he is. Now, you got to hear me carefully. You got to listen really carefully this morning, or you're going to think I said things I didn't. The Bible does teach us that God is a law-giving judge. I'm going to teach you why this morning. That's the goal. And I'm going to wreck a lot of you. I hope, I really hope to wreck a lot of you the way you see the rules in the Bible today. Because when we look at these, we will end up coming to them thinking, somehow I have to keep these for God to be okay with me. Somehow, if our nation doesn't get, like, you'll hear this, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. If we would just come back to keeping these rules, if we could get this grocery stores closed again on Sunday, if we could stop this problem, we could write these laws, we could make everybody obey what God has said, America would be great. You need to hear this. When the psalmist says, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the only way God is the Lord of us, of you, is when we believe the gospel. You can be a great member of any religion and keep the Ten Commandments, and your God is not the Lord. But somehow this view of I'll only be okay, I'll only be blessed, we as a people will only be okay, we'll only be blessed if we figure out how to keep the rules. And so what happens is we try to legislate our way into this. We try to go to self-discipline. We go to all kinds of self-improvement to get better. And we think, man, if we can just improve ourselves and get the nation to be cool with this, we'll be okay. But see, that turns into silliness too. And for those of you who don't know who Stephen Colbert is, I just want to set this next little video clip up. Stephen Colbert is a political satirist, okay? He's a guy who does a show that he makes fun of pretty much everybody. He does tons of interviews. And it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican, a conservative or a liberal, doesn't matter what party, where you come from. When he sits down with you, he is going to press and make fun of your viewpoint, especially when your viewpoint has some real inconsistencies in it. And so what I want to do is I want to show you a video of Stephen Colbert, who is interviewing a Republican senator for, or a Republican representative from Georgia who is super conservative, who wanted to push through Congress a bill that said we ought to put the Ten Commandments in every courthouse. Okay? And that's what this conversation is about. And so I wanted to show it to you. So watch the screen. If you missed that last shot, it was brilliant. Yeah. Thank you for taking time out to not keep the Sabbath day holy with me. I mean, he, you know, just basically, I guess I did this interview on a Sunday or a Saturday or whatever, you know. So, but here's the problem. You see the problem here, okay? We stand up and say, man, if we can just get our country, if we can just get ourselves, if we can just keep the rules, our world would be all right. God would like us. Our lives would be okay. We will live blessed lives if we keep the rules. We will find acceptance in God if we keep the rules. And so we end up legislating. We end up coming with all these ideas of how we can improve this to keep God's law. But at the end of the day, the very people often who are standing up saying, this is the way we ought to live, don't even know the very rules they're trying to say to the culture, live this way. And as we try to keep them, the truth is we can't. And so if God is, when he gives the Ten Commandments, if his goal is to say, this is how you live and that's it, then actually God has failed in giving these. And what I want to do to show you this morning is in this story of the giving of the law, the Ten Commandments, God is setting up a rhythm, a trajectory that will lead us to Jesus, that ultimately these 10 rules, these 10 commandments, God's top 10, are actually a very clear path to get us somewhere else. And so what I want to do is I want to read the 10 commandments. I'm not going to explain what each commandment. This is not going to be me going, let me explain to you what coveting means. I may do a little bit here and there, but my goal is not to explain the 10 commandments. My goal is to throw this story out here of God giving the law, the 10 commandments, or if you're a Mel Brooks fan, or you know, the 15 commandments, oops, the 10 commandments. It's a hilarious clip where he's playing Moses coming down and he drops one of the tablets in History of the World Part 2. But the 10 commandments... To look at the story and look at what happens in the story and then start creating this path because what will happen is as we read these, every time you read a law of God, you're going to take one of two paths. I want to chart a path for you to take so that every time you read a you must in the Bible, you set out some paving stones. You create a path to get to what God's trying to teach you through it, okay? So grab your Bible, Exodus 20. If you don't have a Bible in your rows, we have Bibles for you. We would love for you to have one of those. Read along with us. Pass them down. Make sure everybody has one. It's on page 53 in that Bible. And this is the story of God giving these laws, giving these rules to the people. What is going on here, the big story is that God is... making a covenant with a nation, the Jewish, the Hebrew people. Last week, Michael did a great job. Michael Shattuck did a great job of telling us about how God delivered these people, how he rescued them from slavery, how he parted a sea, how he miraculously worked to deliver them. And 2 weeks ago on Easter, we looked at how in that story, what God did is God brought them to himself and he has delivered them. He has made a relationship. He has brought them to him. And now he is in relationship with these people. And now he's going to teach them how to live with him as their God. That's the key. So look at this. Exodus chapter 20, it says, God spoke all these words saying. Now, first thing here is that if you study this in the Old Testament or if you were to become a Hebrew scholar, you would never use the word the Ten Commandments. What they would call these are the 10 words. We get commandments from the New Testament quoting where it says God commanded this, but in this text, it's the 10 words. God is giving us the 10 words, and he says this, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Here it is. Before he says, how do you live? He is reminding them what he has done, that God has saved them. He has rescued them. He has loved them, and this is so important. Hear me, if you think the Ten Commandments ought to be in a courthouse, great. I don't care. But the Ten Commandments are not given to people who don't know the God of the Bible. It is not a universal thing for everybody to follow. Now, what the Bible teaches is that these commandments are on the heart of every person, showing us that God is a holy God. We'll talk a lot about that next week, and that our lives are not in line for this. But this is not... A thing to put on the courtroom for people who don't know God to follow. This is given out of the context of a relationship to the Hebrew people. And here's the core. He is saying, I am now your God. You are my people. In Exodus 19, there's this beautiful story that we talked about on Easter where God said, I brought you to myself. I am entering this covenant relationship. I'm going to make a ton of promises and I am going to keep all of them. But what I want you to do is live with me as your God. And as you live with me as your God, you obey what I tell you to do. And they say, we will do it. We agree. We love you. We were slaves 2 weeks ago. We were getting beaten, whipped, and now we are free people. We know that this couldn't have happened if you didn't do it for us, God. You are a great God. Just tell us what to do. And the whole context is this covenant where God is now going to say, with me as your God, this is what it looks like to live. This doesn't make sense for anybody who doesn't begin there. The starting point is a relationship with your Creator. And so what happens is that God gives them this and he says, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make yourselves a carved image or any likeness or anything that is in heaven above or in the earth beneath or that is in the water underneath the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Now, number one, no other gods before me. Commandment number two, no idols. Don't make any images that replace me or become the path to worship any god. And this is what he says, because I am a jealous God. That freaks us out. I'm going to explain it to you. I'm a jealous God. And when people live in a relationship with me and they live in a way where their worship is right, it's pure, it's going to create trajectories that last for generations. And so, jealous God, really jealous? I mean, you know, when we think of jealousy, we think of, you know, a middle school girl who likes a guy and he's kind of like, I like you, and then he's talking to some other girl and there's fits of rage and craziness, or we see drunken stupors and people throwing stuff at each other. I mean, you know, this is what we think of jealousy, this rage of emotion that is always wrong. But hear this, okay? There is a big difference of being jealous of someone and being jealous for someone. Jealous of is when I see somebody and I just am so consumed by emotion, whether it's a girlfriend, a boyfriend, a wife, some guy or girl that I wish would fall in love with me, and I try to manipulate. Being jealous of becomes then a manipulative emotion. But I am married to my wife. I love her. We're going to have our 25th anniversary this summer, and I want to let you know that I am very jealous for her. I want her to know every day how much I love her, how I will always pursue her. I tell her all the time, baby, if you ever leave me, I'm going with you. And I have eyes that I really don't have to use, but you need to hear this. I have eyes where I notice if anybody else is looking at her the wrong way, and I want her to always be reminded that the best place for you is right here. The best place for you is right here. You leave here, it doesn't go well for anybody. And I want to tell you, that's a good thing when you are married. It's a good thing. Now, being jealous of her so that, you know, anytime she, you know, is walking, I'm always looking at every guy and freaking out, thinking they're flirting with her and just being silly with it. No, but being jealous for her is a good thing. And you need to hear this. When God says I'm a jealous God, he's not jealous of you. He's not like, if she doesn't like me, I am just not cool. But he is very jealous for you. And he wants you to know that the best place for you is right here. And he will pursue you. He will reach you. He will demonstrate his love. He will show this all throughout the Old Testament, that even when they stray, even when they commit spiritual adultery against him, the Bible begins to use marriage language of the relationship of God's people with him, that God says, I will pursue you. I will bring you back, but it will not go well for you, because the best place for you is right here. And when you leave right here, it's never going to go well. And that's what he says. He says, so then when people hate me, when they turn against me and they despise me and they run away from me, there's like 3-4 generations of brokenness that's going to happen. But I will show my steadfast love to thousands when people hear my call to them and they love me. They respond to my love by loving me. And so this is what he says. And then he goes on, he keeps talking, and he says, you shall not take the name of your Lord, your God, in vain. Don't take God's name in vain, which is not just using it as a curse word. It's anytime we use God's name in a flippant way. For the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your works, but on the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord, your God. And you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth and the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land and the Lord your, that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything else that is your neighbor's. And so here's, he says, listen, remember the Sabbath, which is a rhythm of life of worship and rest. That he sets aside for the Hebrew people. I'm not going to go deep in this, but just real quick. There's two groups who take this and kind of run a little past, and they don't interpret it through the New Testament. So number one, hear this. Hebrews says that for the believer in Jesus, your Sabbath is Christ. He is your eternal rest, okay? Number two, there are some who say, but it says here, remember the Sabbath, therefore we ought to keep Sunday as a day where we don't do anything, we don't work, we don't, you know, do those sorts of things. And there's a whole other group of people who say, nope, the Sabbath is actually Saturday. Christians who went to Sunday for worship actually left the faith. I'm just letting you know, I don't think any is totally accurate. I think that God is giving the people a rhythm of life. But our Sabbath is Christ. That's in Hebrews. We can talk about that later. I'm not going to stay there a long time, just throwing that out. Honor your parents. Don't kill anybody. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't bear false witness, which means don't lie, especially when it is a testimony. Don't covet, which means don't start desiring something. Here's a sin of the heart. Don't start desiring something so greatly that it consumes you, whether it's something your neighbor has or your neighbor's wife. Don't have this inordinate desire that demonstrates that you want something more than God. And so what happens is in these rules, as God gives this to them, there's some things that take place. First of all, never forget that this is God's speech. God is the one who gives this. Therefore, he has a very deep and intended purpose out of this. And he wrote the commandments himself. He doesn't tell Moses what to say. He writes it on stone and gives it to him. And they're given in this relationship out of covenant. Another thing is that the Ten Commandments are actually a preamble for the rest of the law. This is, in the United States Constitution, we have the Bill of Rights. We the people, in order to form more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility. Thank you for Schoolhouse Rock for that, right? We have the preamble, which has the Bill of Rights, and then the Constitution, the laws of the United States are based on that. Very similar. This is a form of a treaty between a king and lesser subjects where the king is giving laws, and it's the preamble. There's actually a total in the Old Testament of 613 laws. And we read some of them and they're kind of weird. Some of them are like, okay, that makes sense. And then some of them over here are kind of bizarre. And what do we do with all these rules? How do we make sense? Do we keep it all? Are some of them just for those people? How does this look? Especially the one that says, don't eat pork and catfish. A lot of us are in big trouble because we love going to Super Smokers or we love those catfish fries, right? And so what do we do with these? But they're given to the people. The Ten Commandments are the preamble for the other 613 laws that are in the Old Testament. But at the core, something is going on. And Martin Luther, the reformer, as he was writing his commentaries on this, said this, that really the entire Ten Commandments and the entire law of God begins with Commandments 1 and 2. And that the rest of the Ten Commandments, the other eight commandments, and the entire rest of the law is a commentary on Commandments 1 or 2. So commandment number 1 is no other gods beside me, before me, no other gods. Commandment number 2 is do not make graven images. Don't create idols. And this is what Luther was saying to us. He was saying that here's the deal. What God at the core is saying is, I have rescued you, I have saved you, and I brought you to me. The issue is not what is your behavior. The issue is who is your God? Who is the consuming center of your life? Where does your worship? We're all worshipers. We worship something. And what happens is, the truth of the matter is, whatever we worship, we will become. If we worship stuff, stuff, we'll become a materialist. If we worship women and sexuality, we'll become a pervert. If we worship our kids, we'll become a crazy parent who is overbearing. We will become whatever we worship. And God says, at the center, I am calling you to have a different God. And when God, the true God of the Bible, is your God, it will change the way you do life. You will see everything differently because you will have God at the center of who you are. And he is telling the Jews, and he's telling you and I, here's the big deal. No other gods. Well, what about the idols? Well, what's going on is that idol is then an avenue to worship God, whatever God you have. And so in the Bible, they would start creating these idols, and nobody believed that a calf or a pole or some other thing was truly their God, but it became like this connection between them and God. They wanted something tangible that would help them get to the object of their worship. And what people did in Old Testament times is they would end up with worship of something. So they would, if their true God was materialism, they would create a God that was the God of stuff. If their God, if their the real God that they had was a God of sexuality, they would then create ways to worship. The idols became paths to worship their God. And what God is saying to the Hebrew people is, no other gods, and don't ever create a tangible path to worship me. Now we do this. We are idol worshipers. Every heart is an idol factory. That's what John Calvin said, that we are prone to wander, prone to leave the God I love. And as we wander, we will worship. We will start giving ourselves to something other than the true God. And what we will do is we will find a different God and we will create a path to worship that God. And we do it all the time. No, we don't create cows to worship fertility gods. But we do have magazines in places right across the river that are houses of worship of those gods. We don't create a statue that is an object of our worship of materialism, but man, we build malls really well in America, right? And what God is telling his people is, he's saying, listen, the nations around you, they all pursue different gods because they want different things. This is what I want for you. I want you to realize you have a different God now. You don't have the God of the Egyptians. I beat those gods with the plagues. You do not have the gods of the Canaanites where you're going. I, the Lord, am your God. You stay right here. Don't ever leave this. And you trust in me. And don't start creating avenues to worship so that somehow you can get what you want in some other way. You realize that I am the source of everything good in your life. And so what Luther began to say is this, that when we get those two right, the rest of the other eight commandments, the other 613 laws fall into place. Because ultimately, what is adultery? Adultery is that I have found something I think is better to me than God. I have made a God out of it. And if I can have that woman, if I can have that man, my life will now make sense. And adultery, then we create an avenue of worship through a sexual experience, thinking my life will work if I have this person. And so all adultery is it's not at the core a relationship problem between two people. Adultery is that I've replaced God with a different God. I've created an idol, an avenue to worship that God. And now that's what adultery is. Stealing, same thing. I've decided that this stuff is more important than God. I have begun to worship this stuff or something in my life, and now I've created a path to get to that. And so when God says, thou shalt not steal, it's all about who is your God. It's not about what is your behavior. The entire Ten Commandments is based on this. You can read it. Why does God say don't covet? Why at the core does God say, listen, don't even do it in your heart? Because worship is a heart issue, and you can come to church and never steal anything, but your heart is all consumed with, if I just had this stuff, or if I just had this dude, or if I just had this job, my life would work. And you can sit quietly in church and live your whole life never stealing, never committing adultery, but in the core of your heart, you've spent your whole life with a different God. And so the whole Ten Commandments are driving us back to the first two. Who is your God? Is the God of Scripture, as he's revealed himself, the center of who you are? Or have you created up other things that your ultimate reality? And so the law of God is given to his people to say, who is your God? Well, they ask Jesus then, what's the most important commandment? He says, here it is. The whole law summed up in this. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. If you do those two things, the rest of the law is all consumed there. See, he's saying the same thing. He's just spinning it to a positive. Instead of no other gods before me, Jesus says, love God with everything you are. The rest of the law will take care of itself. So loving God, having this passion, this pursuit of God is the center. And so what happens here is that as we read these, we will create one of two paths. We'll say 10 commandments and we'll go, I have to keep them. And so we'll create a path that is called what I'm going to call this morning, the path of self-righteousness, which is basically creating a path that says, here's the rule. I need to keep it. I got to figure out how to do it. So here's the rule. Don't kill. I never kill anybody. I must be okay with God, right? Never whack nobody. That person, there are people in jail who whack somebody. I'm better than they are. Don't commit adultery. I'm okay with that. Love my wife. Yeah, there was that girl back in high school, but you know, that was a long time ago. But I've been good recently, right? Don't steal. I don't steal like those people, though, right? And we start taking this, and the path of self-righteousness is just saying, here's the rules. I'm going to do the best I can to live in it. I'm going to walk in it. I'm going to be the good person. There's a good God. He loves good people. I'm going to be the good person. I'm going to walk in it. Now, there's a reverse path of self-righteousness, which is when people look at it and go, I don't believe in a God who makes rules. I'm going to create a God who's just loving. I'm just going to reject the whole system altogether. I think it's narrow-minded. And what ultimately people who go that route, it is still self-righteousness. I am cool with God because God just wants me to love and be free and be wonderful. And the legalists are the religious freaks. Just don't give me any of that. I was, you know, just watching stuff this week, searching, and I saw an old video clip with George Carlin, comedian, who basically did a bit on the Ten Commandments. And what he did is he basically said, let's deal with these. They're used to control people, and so let's deal with them. And he reduced the Ten Commandments down to one commandment. And here's what the one commandment was. Keep your religion to yourself and be okay with everybody. He took this top 10 and said, here's the only commandment. Don't be a religious freak. Keep your religion to yourself and just be free and loving to everybody and all the world will go right. But see, that's self-righteousness. That's the same thing as the crazy legalist who says, you got to keep the rules. He's saying, listen, your God is crazy. Here's how you're okay with yourself with the rules and you'll be happy. And of course, the crowd erupted in applause. But here's the deal. George Carlin and a crazy religious legalist, they're on the same path. They're justifying themselves based on how they respond to the rules that God has given. And here's the deal. That is not what God intended with the law. It's actually not what he intended in the Old Testament. It's definitely not what he intends now that the gospel is clear to us and Jesus has come. He actually is doing something totally different by giving us these 10 laws, the 613 commands. What I want to do is I want to explain this to you. And there are, as we read the whole Bible, there's basically six paver stones, right? That I want to lay out that creates a path. I don't know about you, but we you know, it's springtime, which means it's time for us to do yard work. And we've done this a couple times where we've gone and we've bought paver stones like this one. And we create, you know, either a deck or a porch area or something like that, or a patio, or sometimes you just put these down because you want to have a place to get from point A to point B, and as you get from point A to point B, you don't want to get your feet muddy, and so you create like a little path. Well, what I'm going to show you is I want to take one of the laws and show you how to work through a six-path direction with every command in the Bible. Because every command is trying to take us to the gospel. But how do we get there? Okay, so six stones, and here's the first one. First paver stone we're going to lay down is this. The first thing is that every law in the Bible is teaching us something about the character of God. The law is showing us the character of God. And so we're going to pick one this morning. I'm just going to kind of walk through the whole thing. Here it is. Don't commit adultery. which at the core is saying, listen, don't come to the point where you give yourself sexually to anybody but your wife or your husband. And the world says, that's narrow-minded. Well, what is God trying to accomplish? And the first thing is this, he is showing us something about himself. Every time you read an imperative in the Bible, every time you read a command, you need to realize that before he's telling you anything about you, he is showing you something about himself. So what is the Bible, when God says don't commit adultery, what is the Bible trying to teach us? Well, as we read the whole Bible, what we're going to find out is that God, at the very core, he is a faithful God. That God will never leave his people. He will not abandon us. He will not betray us. He will not turn to us. That God is a faithful God. And he created us in the image of God, which means at the core, our fulfillment, our happiness, our hope is all wrapped up in us being like him. And he's given us marriage as an earthly picture of that. And at the very core, before don't commit adultery is about anything between you and your husband, between you and your wife. Don't commit adultery is a declaration that there is a great God. He will never, ever leave you. He loves you. He will pursue you. He is not going to cast you out, and he is not going to run to another woman. That's a great thing, right? Most of our reading go, man, this is confining. We, you know, this is our, like our culture right now. That's all they're talking about. But before there's anything about what I do in this command, there is something about who God is. Find that. Always find that. Always find how the command is a call to be like God and to find his character, his image. Why does God say don't kill? Because he is the author of life, right? So the first paver stone we have to do before we do anything else is go, what is this teaching me about who God is? What is this teaching me about his character? What is this teaching about his greatness? What is this showing me about what it means to live my life right here with my God? Every command, every law is something about the character of God. Second thing is this, that every law reveals our guilt. Every law reveals our guilt. So, the next paver stone, I'm making my path to the gospel. While other people are going to read these and come up with self-righteousness, the second path that I'm going to lay down is this. That every law that is in the Bible is there to show me that I am hopeless. And it is to expose who I am in my heart. It is to reveal that I am guilty. You go over to Matthew chapter 5 where Jesus himself is teaching on some of these laws. He says, you've heard it said, don't commit adultery. But I say to you that if you've lusted after a woman in your heart, you've already passed it. What? Wait a minute. Hold on. Dude, I've never slept with another woman. But you're telling me if I've ever had a lustful thought, I'm just as guilty before God? Yeah. That's what Jesus is getting at. If you've thought it in your mind, I mean, let's be honest, any of us who've read Sports Illustrated swimsuit this edition and we're male, we passed that point, right? Every guy in here, we're toast. Any woman who's ever read a romance novel, right? Because the law is there to reveal our guilt. It's not to say live this way. I mean, it is, but we can't, because as we begin to go down this. Paul has this amazing argument in Romans 7. Look at what he says. He's talking about coveting. He says, what then shall we say? That if the law is sin, by no means. Yet if I had not been for the law, I would not have known sin. For I would not have known what it is to covet if the law had said, you shall not covet. But sin, seizing the opportunity through the commandment, produced in me all kinds of covetousness. For apart from the law, sin lies dead. Now, listen to what he's saying. This is Paul's argument. He's saying, I was a coveter. I just didn't know it was wrong. But then I read the Ten Commandments said, thou shalt not covet. And all I could do is go, oh, stink. That ain't good, right? Like, if this is the basis of me going to heaven, it reveals his guilt. It's Paul who is the, before he met Jesus, was the ultimate legalist. He was a Pharisee. He kept these rules to a T. But he said, I read the covet law and went, yeah, even though on the outside I went to church and everybody thought I was perfect, on the inside I wanted people's stuff and people's women all the time. And I realized that there's something black and dark in my heart. How did he find that out? The law revealed it to him. And so hear this, at the very core, the law is here to show us that we can't keep it. We cannot keep it, which leads to the third favor stone is this, that the law wrecks self-righteousness. The law absolutely wrecks self-righteousness. So the third favor stone that you should always put down is this. When I read the law, it shows me something about God. It shows me my own sin, which means the next step is it goes, therefore, if I'm getting to God based on my goodness, there's no hope. There's no way. It wrecks anything in me that says I'm better than everybody else. See, that's what we do. We know, well, yeah, do you sin? Sure. Nobody's going to say, I've never sinned. But our rationale, when you're a legalist, when you become the path of self-righteousness, what you do is you say, yes, but I'm better than those people and I'm doing the best I can. And the law is going to wreck that. It's going to ruin that in us so that we can't look and go, well, I'm a good person. God's got to be okay with me. Look at how Paul says this in Romans 3. He says, now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. What Paul's saying here is what the law does is it keeps me from looking at God going, but I'm a good person. You have to be okay with me. I'm a religious person. You have to be okay. The law wrecks that. It actually is there to ruin our hope of saving ourselves, of being self-righteous. And we've got to find those three laws before I go, I'm going to keep the law. Like we'll read it and we'll go, it says don't kill. I'm going to do that. The path to the gospels go. This tells me something about God. It shows my own guilt that I am guilty about this on some level. And as we read the whole Bible on this, it will find this. And therefore, I can't save myself. I have no hope of saving myself. But see, then that leads us to the fourth paver stone. And the fourth paver stone on this path is this, that the law is fulfilled by Jesus in my place. The law is fulfilled by Jesus. And so I have to take this paver stone, I have to put it down. And I have to make sure that as I walk the path, every law. So we're back to don't commit adultery. Shows me something about God. Ultimately, it's going to show me that I have failed in this somehow. Therefore, I can't save myself. And here's the big deal that we can't ever miss. The law then shows us that Jesus did it for us. Our hope is not in our righteousness, our keeping of the rules. Our hope is that Jesus kept the rule for me. I became a follower of Jesus when I was 7 years old, which means God made me right with him and made me righteous. But here's the deal. If you ask me, are you a law keeper? Do you keep the rules? The clearest biblical answer is, I don't. But Christ has kept it for me, and therefore I do. I am not a law keeper on my own. I can't keep the law. But Christ has kept the law for me. And so here's what the Bible does. Matthew 5:17, Jesus says this, I didn't come to abolish the law, to do away with it. I didn't come to wreck it. I came to fulfill the law. And so here's what the Bible is. You got the whole Old Testament, 613 laws. It's like a guy I heard talking about this week. He said he had a job that he was going to hire. He knew exactly who he wanted to hire, but he was required to make a national search. But he knew the guy. He's like, I want to hire this guy. This guy needs to be the person for the job. And so what he did is he wrote a job description that described this guy. Did a national search, did a whole bunch of interviews, and the only guy who fit the job description was the guy that he wanted to hire in the first place, right? That's what the Old Testament is. The Old Testament is a job description for something that honors, for the person who honors God. And the whole Old Testament is writing a job description, and that you start pointing at everybody else who's ever lived on a planet, and that person's not it. And then Jesus shows up, and there he is. And he has fulfilled it in our place. You need to hear this. If you're a follower of Jesus, your hope is not that you are a law keeper. Your hope is that Christ has kept the law for you. And I got to put that paver stone down. If I miss this one, I'm going to revert back to, so I got to try harder. No, the whole goal of the Ten Commandments is this. Christ did it for me. He lived the perfect life that I should have lived in my place for me. And for a follower of Jesus, his righteousness has been given to you. If you're not a follower of Jesus, this is what the Bible's promising, that he's not going to look at your works. He's going to look at the work of Christ and give that to you like it's in your bank account. He's going to take your sin and put it in Jesus, take his righteousness and give it to you. One transaction when you trust in Christ. And so that's the fourth paver stone. Fifth paver stone then is that the law then leads us to Christ. So I pick up the stone and I put it down in my path. And here's what it does. Galatians tells us that the law is like a tutor, like a school teacher that leads us to faith in Jesus. That literally, it works like this. So here we go again. One more trip here. I read a commandment. Don't commit adultery. Tells me something about God. He is faithful. It shows me that I can't keep it and shows me my guilt. It leads me to see, therefore, that I can't save myself. But then I look to Jesus, and he is perfectly faithful like the law requires. And therefore, the law then is a connect the dots from the rules to the person of Christ in the gospel. It leads me there. And then when I find that place, I realize that the book of Hebrews tells me that the last paver stone is that God writes the laws, his law, on the heart of those who trust in Jesus, who know him. And therefore, what happens is that God begins to change a person from the inside out to love the things that are God. We become like what we worship. And when God is the center of our affections, he is the center of our joy, all of a sudden what matters to God matters to us. And all of a sudden we have a different God than the world around us. Therefore, our lives look different because of that. The law is written on our hearts. And so like one person who's in our congregation, I was having a congregation, said, I want to keep the law. It's the joy of my heart to do what God desires. I want to obey and live there. The legalist will never want to. They will feel like they have to. Or they will throw God and the law out altogether. But the gospel produces in us a love for God, which leads to a love for what matters to him. And our lives are transformed inside out. So don't commit adultery. It tells me something about God. It shows me that I am guilty. If I can't do all this, I can't keep the law perfectly. It shows me that I can't save myself, but it shows me that Christ has kept the law for me. It works like a school teacher, a schoolmaster that leads me then to look to Jesus and the gospel as my hope. And when I trust in Jesus, I begin to have a life change from the inside out because of the gospel. And I begin to love my wife. I begin to love my kids. I begin to live in the world with a different God. And that's how the law is supposed to work. Remove any of these paver stones, you'll get your feet muddy. You're going to mix up law and gospel. You're going to begin to say, well, I know that I gave my life to Jesus when I was 7, but he really likes me because I do this. And what the law is there, completely there, is to show us Christ. And so that's the goal. So just a couple quotes, and then I'm going to get off stage and let the band come up here and lead us in worship. I hope this is shaped the way. I can't do everything I would have liked to have done this morning about what the law is. It is a point of real confusion in religious people. I don't care what you grew up in, Baptist, Catholic, Methodist. I mean, it doesn't matter. There is something where somebody said, this is the way you need to be a good person. This is the way God will be pleased with you. And that is saying, yeah, believe the gospel, but trust in the law somehow to make you okay before God. And just keep laying these paper every time you come to a command. And so in this, Charles Spurgeon said this, what is God's law now? It's not above a Christian. It's under a Christian. Some men hold God's law like a rod in terror over Christians and say, if you sin, you will be punished with it. It is not so. The law is under a Christian. It is for him to walk on, to be his guide, his rule, his pattern. We are not under law, but under grace. Law is the road which guides us, the rod which drives us, not the spirit, and nor the spirit which actuates us. The law is good if it keeps its place. And then this quote, this poem is attributed to John Bunyan. Run, John, run, the law commands, but gives me neither feet nor hands. Far better news the gospel brings. It bids me fly and then gives me wings. When you read the imperatives, the rules of the Bible, make sure they lead you to the gospel first. because if they don't, you'll mess them up. And for a lot of us in this room, the rules are a stumbling block to faith. I can't keep all those rules. I just want to let you know, that's why they're there. They're there to show you you can't. They're there to show you that there's a Savior who is good. Trust in him. And for those of us who, maybe we found Jesus, but man, we still struggle thinking our acceptance is in our performance. Start figuring out what it looks like to throw these paver stones down in your life and to constantly run to Jesus and just trust him to do a work from the inside out. But make sure he is your God. Make sure he is your God. Lord, we love you today. We praise you. We just ask you to keep teaching us about this issue and to make it real and big in us. We just pray that as we worship here and as we give our tithes and offerings, that we will do it out of a heart, not a heart that thinks you will like me if I sing loud, or you will like me if I write checks, or you will like me because I'm at church, because that's legalism. Lord, let us respond to you now because you are a great God and we love you. We've found in you something that is better than anything else on this earth. You're jealous for us. So let us find our hope in the fact that you love us. And let us respond with hearts that are overjoyed because the gospel is true. In your name I pray. Amen. Let's stand together. Let's worship Jesus, all right?